Well, that was nice. I often say we are a singing church, but that was an extra amount of singing, which was really, really glorious and fun. We love Living Waters, you know, I just want you to know that. And this week with Foundation Camp is an extra boost, which we also love in a special way. All three of our kids went through FC. Two of our kids were 2 years on summer staff, and then about two more years as Foundation Camp staff. So we love everything about Living Water. So glad you're here with us this morning. We're talking about the tyranny of transactional worship and why men are uniquely tempted. We just sang, heart of my own heart, whatever befall, whatever is coming our way, whatever hard stuff is coming our way, he is still going to be our Father. So that's sort of an introduction. Speaking of one of our kids, our oldest son, Ryan, and his family moved to Wausau last month or so to be near their in-laws since Ryan got a fully remote job, so he's able to do that. They had spent about 8 years in the Minneapolis area, so they are really missing their church that they came to love and especially, of course, their friends. One thing Ryan noted that he also missed was Facebook Marketplace, which seems like an odd thing to miss. Probably all exchange, and we just sold something yesterday on Facebook Marketplace. You've probably done that. You can imagine how many more options there are in Wausau and how many more in Minneapolis area. Nothing compared to that, right? The availability of goods in a metro market helped Ryan become a really good negotiator. So he would put something for sale and would not budge the price. He would get all these offers and like $10 off on a $300 item. Nope. Someone's going to come along and pay the full $300. So I don't know where he learned those skills, but he's become a skilled negotiator also when it comes to job offers. So this last time he got two extra offers and pitted them against each other, against his current employer. So that was like three companies at the negotiation table until he got what he thought was the sweetest deal. But he works hard at it. He actually applied for more than 100 remote jobs in under 6 months. So if you want a job, young people, work hard at it. But these skills of negotiation work great on Facebook Marketplace or in the job marketplace. But what I'm saying this morning is they're deadly in our worship. They kill our worship. They're soul-sucking in our worship. Transactional worship is giving something to God and expecting something back in return. If I serve him, if I follow him, then I expect him to meet all of my needs. I'm not going to have something I don't want, and I'm not going to want something I don't have. That's transactional worship. If I do X, God must. And there's the key. God must reward me with X, whatever that is. Now, you may think that's prosperity theology. It sounds a bit like it, but it's not. Now, granted, prosperity theology fits under the broader category of transactional worship. It clearly is that. But we don't have to hold to a full prosperity position to fall into this deadly trap of transactional worship, which brings us to Job. If you want to turn to Job chapter 1, I'm going to read that through. There are many ways to dissect Job's story. And I think one of the most obvious ones is this topic of transactional worship. So as I read the chapter, as you follow along, see if you can pick up on these clues, these examples of transactional worship. And I'll give you a clue. It comes straight from Satan's mouth. Verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were brought to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. So this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. Now, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him in his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And there came a messenger to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Probably a familiar passage to you. Point number one this morning, Satan tempts us in the area of transactional worship. That's what we just read. This story illustrates how Satan tempts us to engage in what I'm calling transactional worship. First, let's note Job's integrity. We are told that he was a man who was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. In other words, Job was the model Yahweh follower. And God himself said he is the best of all men. Search the whole land. You will not find a better Yahweh follower. That's why Satan was attacking him. There's no one like him in all land. He represents a right relationship with God better than anyone else. Another way of saying it is that he was the ideal target for Satan. So when Satan entered the presence of God, he was literally drooling with excitement at the prospect of taking Job down. This is why Peter wrote thousands of years later, "Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour." Satan himself said, "I'm walking around to and fro." That's what he's doing. He was a roaring lion. If Satan could take down Job next to Adam and Eve, I think that would have been his greatest achievement. But then Satan answered the Lord and said, I'm going to highlight a few of these. Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land, but stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to his face. Do you see it, right? That's so obvious. How Satan tempted Job with transactional worship. Because Satan assumes Job is already, do you see? It's not something that's tempting him. He's already transacting his worship with God. Here's what it's all about. If God supplies all that he wants, Job will worship God. But if all those things are removed from Job, Job will curse God to his face. But here's how round one ended. Immediately after Job loses everything, we read, as we just read, "In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong." Job may have been tempted by transactional worship, but he did not succumb to transactional worship. Then verse 4 begins what we could call round 2. Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. All that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." This is the same temptation of transactional worship and the very same outcome. In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. So it would appear at least, that Job prevailed and successfully defeated Satan's temptations. Satan's evil desires and loud roaring did not cause Job to succumb to temptation. Now, that would have been the case had the book ended at chapter 2. That would have been the end of it, right? But there are 38 more chapters to go, and here is what we see. But before I give you point number 2, let me ask you. It's easy to worship God when life is going well. It's so easy. It's so easy. So might you already, without any other external temptation, might you already be engaging in transactional worship with the Lord? Because life is good, because you're happy, it's easy to worship Him. Keep that in mind. Because here's what we see in the story. Suffering can lead to its own form of transactional worship. Now, let's give Job the credit he deserves. He demonstrated enormous faith through his trials. He lost everything and everyone, but yet he still refused to curse God. We look at him and probably conclude, I don't have enough faith. There's no way possible I would have made it through round 1, let alone also round 2. But the rest of the book shows us that the long-term impact of Job's suffering, and they show it in living color. Satan may have lost the first couple of battles, but what he got out of this was a much longer war. That's the whole book of Job. It's a much longer war of temptation. Job's transactional instinct didn't disappear. It just sort of went underground. Job's suffering had a cumulative effect on him. It's one thing to face something hard short term, but to endure something over the long term, it has a cumulative effect upon us, which is how our life can also go. We can handle an occasional setback or even a catastrophe, but the slow grind of suffering can be very different. A chronic illness that lasts for decades can chip away at your soul faster than a near-death experience. I've said many times standing here that the Bible teaches us how to lament. If you don't know about lament, I encourage you to read the book Dark Clouds, Deep Mercy. Dark Clouds, Deep Mercy. One of the most transformational books that I've read in my entire life. Lament is of tremendous value, which you cannot actually understand fully until you actually engage it, until you actually lament. Lament is the right response to real suffering. Suppressing grief isn't faith. Let's say that again. Suppressing grief isn't faith. It's emotional dishonesty. And God is constantly inviting our raw cries. But here's the thing. I think men especially need permission to lament. On our vacation, we just got back from Friday. Karen and I were walking and talking about how I tend to compartmentalize all of my parts of life, right? Sort of one thing at a time, and I'm not bringing in all these 5, 10, 20 other things. Just one thing at a time. And she's like, "How are you not thinking about blah, 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 blah?" Because she's got all those things all at once intertwined. Now, that's sort of, you know, not to be stereotypical, but that is sort of the classic, how men and women tend to sort of process the various parts of their life. So we're talking about that. But then a few days later, I asked her, I just walked along, I said, "What if my, what I call compartmentalizing, is actually a form of denial? Do you see it? Right? This thing is over here, and I'm not thinking about this hard thing because now I'm thinking about this other hard thing." And I say, "Well, I'm just a guy. That's how I compartmentalize." Could also be denial. Now, I don't think it is, but that's That's the whole problem of denial, right? You don't know you're in denial when you're in denial. You just don't. Which is why we need to learn to lament. Now, women tend to be more aware of their feelings, but that doesn't automatically mean they know how to lament. They're just aware of their feelings. Whatever they do with them could be different than lamenting. But if men are not aware of their feelings, they're going to have a much more difficult time lamenting. Do you see that? But here's the problem that we're going to see in the book of Job. Lament pushed too far then also becomes transactional worship. So we have this temptation sort of coming and going in our lives. Job shows us the boundary that lament can cross. If you're with us a couple months ago, I talked about that. What are the right boundaries of what lament actually looks like and how we can cross the line? Well, Job crosses that line. Lament says, God, where are you? This is unbearable. I need you. But transactional worship or transactional grievance says, God, you owe me. I've kept my end. Now I need an answer, and I need it now. The first is relational. It's reaching toward God, even in our pain. The second is judicial. It's summoning God to the courtroom, which is exactly what Job does for the entire rest of this book. He literally is arguing like a courtroom and summoning God to it countless times. Job's language gradually changes from true lament and trust into grievance and a demand for God to show up and answer all of his questions. Lament stays relational and God-directed and is faithful. Lament that hardens into grievance demanding settlement has quietly changed into transactional worship. And I think that's the key. Quietly transformed. Right? You can be lamenting, you can be processing, but then sort of slowly fall into this transactional worship. What happens is you will only be satisfied if God upholds his end of the bargain. What's wrong with that? You're defining what the end of the bargain should be, right? You're trying to define the terms. Now, if all that were not enough, as God-ordained providers, men live in a transactional environment. We understand men are called to provide for their families, and that involves continually living in a transactional environment. You spend 40 or 50 hours a week. Sometimes some of you have jobs that occasionally, seasonally, you're up to 80 hours a week or more during a very busy time, and you get a certain amount of money in return for your efforts. That's a pure transactional environment. Both sides of the arrangement, right, have to hold up their fair share. If one side or the other breaks down, the whole system falls apart. Your employer is legally bound to pay the wages for which you worked. Everybody knows that. That's why when payday comes, we expect our paycheck. Now it just sort of shows up in the bank usually, but we expect that. So this means that for the majority of the hours in your day, you are living and breathing, men especially, in a transactional environment. It's simply what you do and how life works in that arena. You have built-in expectations and a proper sense of entitlement. You are entitled to those wages because you earned those wages. So you can see how easy it might be then to transfer that transactional process into your worship of God, or into any relationship for that matter. You might fall into this quid pro quo arrangement. If God fulfills his end of the bargain, you will do as well. You might be doing it or not even aware of it, sort of like denial, right? You don't know that you're doing it. Someone has to come along and say, would you consider this might be happening? This can bleed, again, into any relationship, but it's especially dangerous in our relationship with the Lord. So then, with all this, how do we fight against this temptation? I believe at least one of the answers is that we are to take leadership over our joy. I think we'd all agree that what drives transactional worship is the hard stuff in life. Now, again, I'm saying we can be engaged in transactional worship when life is easy, but especially it can come about like Job experienced in the hard times. when life goes our way, we don't generally have any complaints about God, how God is treating us. But when life gets hard, it reveals our transactional worship. But our transactional worship is hidden when life is easy behind our prosperity, behind our comfortable, easy lives, which is exactly why Satan showed up in this book, right? When Job had everything going just perfectly. Even though Job never actually cursed God, that's true. The Bible says that twice. He didn't curse God with his lips. His lament clearly turned into transactional worship. Now, how do we know that? Because God spent four chapters chastising Job. That's how we know that. James, Jesus' own brother, famously speaks to this when he wrote, "Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." The key word here, I believe, at least one of the key words, is count, or in some translations, consider. Consider it all joy. And that's literally what it says in the original language, all joy. Count it all joy. So that word count or consider is the word hegemon, from where we get our English word hegemony. And most of the time, this word is translated as governors, kings, and rulers. So it's a leadership term. So, example, Pilate is often referred to as a hegemon. In Hebrews 13, the same word is used three times to refer to leaders or hegemons in the church. So there's no question that what James is writing here, Jesus' brother, is that this is grounded in the idea of leadership, which then reinforces the point. When you count, consider, or hegemon your trials as joy, you are taking leadership over how you interpret your circumstances. Your circumstances haven't changed, but you're taking leadership over how you interpret those circumstances. So what James does is he picks a word that primarily means to lead and govern and uses it for an act of mind under pressure. So in other words, joy becomes an act of the will. You take leadership over that. Now, as I thought about it, I thought it sounds a little bit too much, in fact, like that phrase, choose joy. We see it shows up on T-shirts and coffee mugs. And I don't really care for that phrase. I think it's well-intended, but it can sound like we're manufacturing an emotion that isn't there. It sounds like you're willing yourself, you're forcing yourself into feeling something that you don't actually feel, which can in turn turn into a type of denial. But to take leadership over your joy is governing the interpretation of suffering and the hard parts of life. You're not faking anything. The joy that follows then isn't manufactured. It's the natural output of an accurate, governed verdict about what the trial is actually doing in your life. So, in other words, rightly interpreted in this way, trials can have an extremely positive effect in our lives. Charles Spurgeon suffered greatly from chronic illness and depression his entire life. This man's life was filled with suffering. Nevertheless, listen to his perspective. And he writes about this often, but this is very powerful. He said, "I'm afraid that all the grace I've got out of my comfortable and easy times and happy hours might almost lie on a penny." Grace, all the good things and benefits. "But the good that I've received from my sorrows and pains and griefs is altogether incalculable. Affliction is the best bit of furniture in my house. It is the best book in a minister's library." Nobody writes like this nowadays, but it's good to review those. So when we take leadership over our trials, we're not in denial. We're not lying to ourselves about how we feel. We are refusing to let trials' impression of tragedy control us, because either the trials are going to lead you, or you are going to lead the trials. What we're doing is exercising our God-given authority over the whole categorization of what a trial means. Trials are not evil. Trials are not God letting us down again. Trials are not good in themselves, right? Let's be clear about that. But when I take leadership over what they mean, if I interpret them, then I see them for their actual benefit, and I end up with joy. And what's one of the benefits here? Steadfastness. When you face trials of many kinds, because you know the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. Don't you want steadfastness? Don't you want to have that steady endurance one day after the other, one foot in front of the other? That's what trials uniquely bring. It's exactly what Spurgeon said. All my good times fit on a penny, but all those other hard things have been the best things in my entire life. Now, all this still allows plenty of room for lament, but instead of lament turning into transactional worship like it did for Job, our lament can turn into joy when you take leadership over your trials. So here's how we see this playing out. Trials will either harden us or they will humble us. And here's the process I would define. Trials come about, and if we allow them to humble us, that produces gratitude, and gratitude always produces contentment and joy. The key there is responding in humility, and that is also a key to taking leadership over your trials. And I would say, fathers, haven't said specifically much about fathers this morning, this is the best form of leadership a father could possibly have. So you think, you know, I'm a Christian man, I'm a Bible man, and so I lead my family, and I, you know, what I say goes, and when there's hard decisions to be made, you know, that's my responsibility, and I got to earn most of the money, you know, I got to be a leader, I got to be a man, I got to be a Christian man. That's all good. That's all good. If you don't just, I sound like a jerk the way I said it. Don't be a jerk when you do that. But all those things in themselves are good. But taking leadership over your trials for yourself and your whole family, do you see how transformational, not transactional, how transformational that could be in your lives, in the lives of your whole family? And the result is, no, you're not getting fewer trials, but you are getting more God. Let's pray. Father, it's amazing when we learn things like this. It can strike us that up is down and left is right, that joy, that trials bring joy. It doesn't make sense at first. So we need your Spirit to continually apply these things, to interpret them for us, to convict, encourage, and comfort. And I ask specifically that every man, especially in this room, whether a boy, a young man, a father, a grandfather, a great-grandfather, would learn a little bit more how to take leadership, Spirit, Holy Spirit-empowered leadership over their trials. In Jesus' name.